Let me just read verse 39. This is David appearing across the Jordan, returning after the defeat of Absalom. So all the people crossed the Jordan, and then the king crossed over. The king kissed Barzillai and gave him his blessing, and Barzillai returned to his home. When the king crossed over to Gilgal, Kingham, that's Barzillai's son, I think that's most likely, crossed with him. All the troops of Judah and half the troops of Israel had taken the king over. Now, this is, ought to be anyway, seen as a great moment. Absalom's rebellion that has been occupying a number of the chapters we've been reading has been defeated. It's the most dangerous rebellion that David faced. God's anointed king has just crossed the Jordan. He's returning to Jerusalem. And it's a very significant return. And in the previous verses, in the earlier verses of chapter 19, we'd seen how David came back, not with his heart full of vengeance and anger, but quite the contrary, with his heart full of mercy, forgiving his enemies, rewarding the faithful. And we sort of feel, at last, things are back on track. God has punished him for his sin. Now, surely, things have been sorted out. And it should be a great moment. But instead of celebration and peace, we get division and trouble. And in fact, this passage is pretty grim. When I first read it, it's not the most obviously attractive passage, is it? It starts with a breakdown of relationships. In the middle, there is a very gruesome murder, which we are not spared any detail at all. And then it ends with a beheading. It's the sort of stuff that makes the Bible X-rated, or at least it would if it was happening in front of you. There's only one reference to the Lord in chapter 20, verse 19. Talks about the Lord's inheritance, the wise woman does. But what God is doing, what God approves or disapproves of in what's happening, is not spelled out in the passage. And David, although he's, you know, very much present, and he does give some commands in verses 3 to 6 of chapter 20, the focus is not on David. He's almost a bystander, while the sort of camera, as it were, follows the men of Israel and the men of Judah, and follows this chap Sheba, son of Bichri, and follows Joab, and follows this wise woman, and it's really hardly about David at all. So what are we to learn from a passage like this? I mean, maybe we simply reflect that trouble is part of our experience in a fallen world. And that is actually true, and it's actually not unimportant to recognize that. If we have unrealistic expectations about what life will be like in this world, we'll be blaming God when he doesn't deliver what actually he never promised in the first place, an easy life. Trouble is part of our experience in a fallen world. In Job 5:7, it says, "Man is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upwards," which is to say, it's kind of in the nature of things that we will experience trouble. And the Bible is very realistic. Some Christians I've met have not been at all realistic. They've actually said falsehoods about how life should be if you were pleasing God, easy and straightforward. And I look at Jesus, who's the supreme person who pleased God, and I wonder how on earth you can say life should be easy and straightforward when you see what happened to him. So actually, yes, trouble will happen. Yeah, of course, encouragements and blessings happen, but there will always be troubles and sorrows. And we've got to have a robust theology of this world, of trouble in this world, so that we are not stumbled by life's troubles. Some people kind of seem to think that, you know, the gospel is basically come to Jesus and he'll make everything lovely. Well, the Bible never says that. It says, come to Jesus and he will finally make everything lovely. But he doesn't promise that until he returns. That's the day when everything will be as it ought to be. And Jesus said, John 16:33, in this world you will have trouble. So we shouldn't be too surprised, should we? Acts 14, Paul says, we must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, I'm not wanting to characterize the Christian life as simply hardship. There are many joys. In fact, there are wonderful and eternal joys. But in this world, we will have trouble. And therefore, we must not despair when life sometimes throws us things we were never expecting. And of course, God uses these things in our lives to drive us to Him and to teach us to invest our hopes not in this world, but in the world to come. And what's going to teach us to do that? If everything we have turns to gold, if everything is wonderful here, if all my children are perfect and my house is a palace and my car's a Lamborghini or whatever you might think is heaven. Okay, if it was everything like that, why would you kind of be excited about heaven? Well, actually, of course, it isn't like that. And heaven is worth being excited about. But I don't think the message of this passage is simply, you're going to have some trouble. I think this passage brings an urgent warning and a great encouragement. And that's what I want us to focus on. You see, firstly, I think there's an urgent warning that's implicit in the whole passage. And that is the danger of being the king's subjects, but not sharing the king's heart. You see, we've broken into the story, but thinking of what Dom preached last Sunday evening, it was wonderful, really, that the heart of generosity that David appears with, the king returns with words of conciliation. I mean, he even spares the life of Shimei, the man who cursed him and threw stones and mud on him. You remember? I mean, you kind of understand why Abishai says, you know, here's my sword. I want to go and sort him out once and for all. And David spares Shimei's life. And he deals graciously with Mephibosheth. And he honors Barzillai. And it's a story of a man who comes as king with a generous heart. But the men of Israel and Judah, well, they've, on the face of it, all come to receive their king back. They're all involved. The people here are involved in the beginning of the passage on the king's side. But everything turns sour in verse 41. It should be a good time, but it becomes a terrible time. Now, I wonder if you recognize that at all. It should be a good time, but it comes a terrible time. Have you ever had a sort of a holiday? And it should be great. Oh, goodness me, you know, you miss the flight or your children get chicken pox or, you know, somebody spills Coke all over the car or something worse, perhaps. And it should be a great time, and it's actually a nightmare. It can happen in churches too, can't it? A church should be a great place to be, and Satan wants to make church a nightmare. And we need to take warning of how Satan works, because why are we told all this? I mean, why do we get this blow-by-blow description of all sorts of somewhat unpleasant things? Well, you see, Satan kind of repeats himself. The things that Satan does here are the sorts of things that Satan still does. When it all goes wrong, when though the king's heart is full of grace, his people's heart are not full of grace. And we need to watch our hearts. So here's a bit of heart surgery, really, in this passage. And I think we need to be very jealous, because in Emmanuel, God has given us something very rich in terms of closeness and fellowship and love and harmony and unity and blessing together. And we should treasure that. And we should be jealous for it. And we should thank God for it. But we shouldn't take it for granted. We should seek and strive. It will be always so. So firstly, what went wrong? Easy resentment. Verse 41. Soon all the men of Israel were coming to the king and saying to him, why did our brothers, the men of Judah, steal the king away and bring him and his household across the Jordan together with all his men? The men of Israel are the northern tribes complaining about the men of Judah, which is the tribe David belonged to. And they use this rather emotive language. They just escorted him across a river. But the way they described it, they describe it as having stolen the king away, as if they were taking the king just for themselves. They took the leading part in restoring David to his throne. Now, it's not actually quite true. You see, look back in what it says in verse 40. At the end of verse 40, it says, all the troops of Judah and half the troops of Israel had taken the king over. Now, they're actually the army of Israel is much larger than Judah. So there are probably actually more soldiers of Israel from the northern tribes escorting David over. It's not actually the precise truth. But you see, in verse 41, it's their narrative about the facts. It's not the facts, but their narrative about the facts. Their poisoned perceptions that become all important. And when things go wrong, that's often how it is. What actually happened is superseded by what you say happened. And you repeat it, and it becomes all the more true. You see, the point is this. The men of Israel did not get the part they wanted. You know, they're like children squabbling over the nativity play because they're not all the one they wanted to be. And here they are. They didn't get the part they wanted. Do you recognize that, though? Because it happens in adult hearts just as much, if not much worse. Sensitivity to your own importance and resentment when someone else gets the attention or the applause or the role that you feel you wanted. And the more you talk about it to yourself, oh, you know, that was unfair. The more you talk about it to other people, wasn't that unfair? The more fired up you become. And sensitivity to your own importance is the kind of poisoned arrow at the heart of this whole situation. It's a killer. It was a killer in ancient Israel, and it's a killer in today's church. Because the trouble is, it puts your heart in a different place to your king's heart. Your king's heart is not like that. So it's a very telling indication something's wrong. You see, we say we follow the Lord Jesus, but actually when we're pursuing resentfully the part of importance we wanted, we're not a bit like Jesus. Beware. We need to sift and guard our hearts from every beginning inclination of this sort of way of thinking. And we need to repent and disown ugly roots of self-importance wherever they appear in our garden. We fight a battle that I expect, if you've got a garden, you are familiar with. I don't know where they come from, but brambles and nettles seem to have a kind of charmed life. And you pluck them out and you think you've dealt with them. And, you know, 2 days later, my wife comes and tells me I've missed this and missed that one. She has a thing about brambles, or at least she's very good at identifying them. And I, do you know, that they keep coming back. And that's, see, I think we need to deal with our hearts on an ongoing basis rather than think, oh, well, we'll never think like that in our church. We need to beware. Do you remember the church leader Diotrephes in 3 John, who the apostle John says loves to be first? It's a killer. It's a killer. Is that how Jesus was? Loved to be first? Is that how he came? He came as an infant in back streets of Jerusalem. He came as to be brought up in Nazareth, you know. Does anything good come from Nazareth? He grew up to be crucified. You see, that's not the heart of Jesus. Loves to be first. Jesus laid himself down. That's what makes us like him, is when we share that sort of sacrificial heart. That's actually what makes churches great places to be. And it's also what make marriages happy. In fact, it's the basis of happy marriages. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. That's the opposite. The opposite what our sinful hearts will lead us. So easy resentment, pluck it out. And then sharp words. Well, we were thinking about that with the children, but it's there, isn't it? Verse 41, why did our brothers, the men of Judah, steal the king away? And it's that language is pretty loaded. Verse 42, all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, we did this because the king is closely related to us. It's unreasonable you're being. Why are you angry about it? Have we eaten any of the king's provision? Have we taken anything for ourselves? Why are you making this fuss about nothing? Okay, verse 43, the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king. In other words, they represented 10 tribes. The 11th is probably Levi, who they didn't represent. They were the priestly tribe, and Judah, which was the king's tribe. So we are 10 tribes, so we have a greater claim on David than you. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Well, we the first of speaking, bringing back our king, but the men of Judah press their claims even more forcefully than the men of Israel. And the narrator at that point doesn't even bother to tell us what they said, because we've got the picture, haven't we? You know, just like the dynamic between Charlotte and Susanna. One says one thing, another says another, another reacts to that, and then before long you've got an explosion. That's exactly what happens here. And it's sharp words. They're like petrol poured on a fire. You see, if you look back to chapter 19, verse 11 to 14, when David's words are described, he sent a message to the elders of Judah. He sent a message to Amasa in verse 13. And having written his words down, it says, verse 14, he won the hearts of all the men of Israel as though they were one man. He won their hearts. Sorry, the men of Judah. The men of Judah, as though they were one man. And what he'd done was use words that won their hearts. Well, the opposite is what the men of Judah, whose hearts were won by the Lord, by their Lord, that is by the king, but when they're in operation, they're not at all like their king. That's a challenge to us. Do our words reflect our king? That's a good question to ask, isn't it? We all know probably Proverbs 15, verse 1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Now, just supposing in verse 42, the men of Judah had said, oh, I do understand how, you know, why you feel bad. We're really sorry that you feel like that. Really, truly, we weren't trying to supplant you at all. Please forgive us and let's make this a very special day. I mean, supposing they'd responded like that. It's just possible, isn't it, that none of this would have happened. I think, in fact, none of this would have happened. Thirdly, there was a troublemaker. Chapter 20, verse 1. Now, a troublemaker named Sheba, son of Bichri. Almost every point, he's called Sheba, son of Bichri. As though, you know, his name was so insignificant, you needed to have the son of Bichri to add in, because otherwise you wouldn't have any idea who this, person was. And anyway, the first thing we learn is not his name, but what he was like, a troublemaker. Now, the situation is that there's a poisonous spirit already at the move between Israel and Judah. And of course, there was a back history. You see, after Saul had died, there'd been a division. David ruled over Judah for 7 years, but the northern tribes followed Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, and you remember there was civil war for 7 years. So the things that are going on here have a sort of root, they have a history. But Sheba plays a particular role in chapter 20, verse 1. Now Sheba, a troublemaker named Sheba, happened to be there. And the word troublemaker is literally a man of Belial. In other words, this is Satan's agent. There's a suggestion, more than a suggestion, of the demonic. Something really sinister here. Troublemakers are playing a sinister game. And he was an opportunist. Verse 1 says he just happened to be there. I mean, presumably, he actually came to be part of the reception for David. I think. He didn't create this breakdown of trust that was already well underway. But when he realizes it's happening, he rides it like a surfer rides the wave. Take hold of this. He's a populist. He's a rabble-rouser. You see, he knows how to get things done, verse 1. He blew a trumpet. That was a sort of sign, a call to arms. And he shouted. He's got a catchy slogan. We have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son. Every man to his tent, Israel. And I suspect he said it again and again and again. And it sort of, you know, there was a kind of, these words began to ring around Israel and in their minds and in their hearts. Why should we follow this man, this David? And the influence, the outcome, verse 2, is that all the men of Israel deserted David to follow Sheba, son of Bichri. That's a pretty horrendous result. So instead of injecting words for peace, Sheba, son of Bichri, sets off an explosion. Now there's a kind of human dynamic. A bad situation has arisen. And then a particular person becomes a catalyst. If you're interested at all in history, and when things go really, you know, things really gather a momentum, it's very often a particular person. So, now there's something about Lenin in the story of the Russian Revolution. There's something about Hitler in the rise of Nazism. There's something about a person who somehow becomes the focus and the voice of something. And it's dangerous. And there's a serious warning here, not to be troublemakers, but also, when there are troublemakers, don't run with them. Because troublemakers only make trouble when people run with them. Okay, the best thing to a troublemaker is to ignore him, or get him to shut up. But don't run with him. Don't be one, and don't run with one. And Romans 16, verse 17, has very practical advice, where Paul says, and he's talking to churches, but you can sort of, when you listen, think of what he says, it's not so dissimilar. I urge you, brothers, to watch out for those who cause divisions and put obstacles in your way that are contrary to the teaching you've learned. Keep away from them. Watch out for them and keep away from them. Dale Ralph Davis says, there are Shebas in the church. Troublemakers, don't be one. And never follow one. And make that your pledge to God. Fourthly, there's a vicious self-promoter. A vicious self-promoter. And of course I'm referring to Joab. Now, Joab is one of the enigmas of 2 Samuel. You know, at times you think, this is a great guy. Other times you think, this is appalling. See, on the one hand, he's David's right-hand man. He fought fearlessly for David. And occasionally, he speaks wisdom to David when no one else is speaking up. In chapter 19, when David was so overcome with Absalom's death that the army comes back to find that instead of being received as, you know, having saved the king, they're received as, you know, it was a day of lamentation. And Joab goes and tells him, you know, you hate those who, you love those who hate you, and you hate those who love you. And I mean, he says some home truths. And I think he rescues David from a situation David was digging himself into. So sometimes you say, this is a really helpful guy to have around. On the other hand, he has a different spirit to David. There was a ruthlessness about Joab and his brother Abishai. Ruthlessness about these two nephews of David. As Dale Ralph Davis puts it, Joab is both intensely loyal and completely uncontrollable. So though he's loyal to David, he's not controlled by David. Another commentator says, Joab's creed was simple. When someone stands in your way, kill him. Well, it all happened before. We're familiar with this story. Back in chapter 3, there'd been somebody else who had been an enemy of David, who David kind of wins over and sends a welcoming message to and brings him into to the leadership of the army and receives him back and honors, and Joab kills him. So back in chapter 3 it was Abner, and here it's Amasa. So in both cases it's history repeating itself. Men honored by David on the same side as Joab. And Joab pretends to be welcoming them. In each case, he's sort of, you know, having a little confidential, affectionate greeting. In fact, he is actually about to murder them. Amasa was actually his cousin. He had been commander of Absalom's army, just as Abner had been commander of Saul's army. But David had specifically reached out to Amasa. If you look back in chapter 19, verse 13, he'd sent a message, the conciliatory message to Judah, in the course of which he said to Amasa, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not the commander of my army, in place of Joab. David had gone out of his way to win this man over. And of course, remember that Joab had just killed David's son Absalom. And however helpful that was to David's position, emotionally, it totally destroyed David, really. So David treats Amasa in chapter 20, verse 4, as a commander. The king says to Amasa, summon the men of Judah to come with me in 3 days and be here yourself. But when Amasa went to summon Judah, he took longer than the time the king had set for him. And I don't know what happened, but he's late. And he's late on a job that needed quick response. So David is very acutely aware of the danger, says to verse 6, Abishai, he doesn't go to Joab, he goes to his brother Abishai, and he says, take your master's men and pursue him, or he will find fortified cities and escape from us. So Amasa is kind of slow on the job. When he does turn up in verse 8 and joins all the others, and Joab is standing there, he is viciously murdered. Now, the account in verses 8 to 13 is very detailed. It's not for the squeamish. Now, it seems, we're obviously meant to notice, in verse 8, he drops his dagger. Now, you kind of think, what's the significance of that? Well, I think the significance of that is his dagger had come out of its sheath, and he stoops down, and I think what he does is he picks it up with his left hand, because his right hand is occupied, verse 9, in greeting Amasa affectionately. You see, he took Amasa, and this wouldn't perhaps be what we do in our culture, but he said to Amasa, how are you, my brother? Then Joab took Amasa by the beard with the right hand to kiss him. That's sort of instructive, isn't it? Remember, someone in a garden came to kiss, when in fact he came to impale. Well, this is sort of happening in an earlier situation in the same way. And he disembowels Amasa. Now, the way the text describes it, it tells you something about Joab. I mean, Joab completely moves on. He seems quite unfazed by what he's done. His conscience seems to be completely calloused. And he just leaves Amasa in this horrific state on the ground. And he's, up and on with the job. And it takes one of his men, who's not named, to actually realize that all his army is sort of stopping with horror, and to remove the gruesome sight of Amasa's body and cover it with something. It just seems to tell you a man whose conscience was so hardened that he didn't really notice. And it's only after Amasa's been removed that everyone went on, verse 13, with Joab. But how utterly effective Joab was. In this world, sometimes ruthlessness can be very effective. From the moment of that murder, Joab becomes commander. I mean, David hasn't reinstated him. But the dynamic is, look at the end of verse 10, then Joab and his brother Abishai pursued Sheba. Verse 11, one of Joab's men stood there. Whoever favors Joab, whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. Verse 13, everyone went on with Joab. Joab's back in charge on the job immediately. There's a kind of ruthless effectiveness about him. Now, you might well say, good gracious, we couldn't be like Joab, could we? But I think that would be unwise to assume that. The extreme example is the warning of a direction of heart. There is a version of loyalty to the king which actually is quite insensitive to the king's will. In other words, I'm in church every Sunday, and maybe I'm a leader in the church or whatever it is. But there are aspects of God's will. It's almost as though God's word hasn't said that sort of thing. And you ignore God's will when it pleases you. You obey Jesus just when you want to. And Dale Ralph Davis quotes Matthew 7:21. Not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. So there are going to be people who say, Lord, Lord, but they won't actually be accepted. There is such a thing as acknowledging the king's sovereignty and disregarding his will. Such folk will have no place in the kingdom at the last. And Dale Ralph Davis says, there are scores of Joabs on our church membership list. It's a frightening comment. You see, what is the principle? Here's a man who is loyal at one level and actually a nightmare on another level. And I've seen just enough of that to sort of think, yes. And it's a sobering warning. Don't just be associated with the king. Share the heart, the gracious heart of the king. Don't be a person of easy resentments. Don't be a person of sharp words. Don't be a troublemaker. Don't promote yourself and say, I'm following Jesus, while you're disgracefully aggressive, or unkind, impure in other areas. Well, that's the warning. That's the heart surgery, the urgent warning. Secondly, there's a great encouragement. And the great encouragement is that actually in this passage, God is at work even when he's scarcely mentioned. And just the same today, God is sovereign even when the media scarcely refer to him. I mean, God never makes the headlines, or hardly ever. How is God at work? Well, in two ways, in God's discipline. See, why has all this happened to David? The trauma of the terrible trouble in his family and narrowly surviving his own son's rebellion. Well, this isn't because God was weak. It's actually because God was strong. Because God was disciplining David. And even here, in his return to his palace in Jerusalem, in chapter 20, verse 3, you see, he has there the 10 concubines that he left to take care of the palace and put them in, take care of the palace when Absalom was approaching. And you remember, those 10 concubines, Absalom, at the advice of Ahithophel, slept with on the roof so that everyone knew it was happening as a means of asserting his desperately earnest purpose to replace his father. Now, these concubines were a continuing reminder of what happened. And, of course, to make sense of it, you need to go back to chapter 12 and verses 10 and 11. Because back in chapter 12, after the incident of his adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah that he organized, the Lord said, you struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes I will take your wives and give them to the one who is close to you. And he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. And that's exactly what happened with these concubines and Absalom. Now, it, of course, raises lots of questions. They're called wives there, and now they're called concubines. And why did he have concubines at all? And why did he have so many wives when manifestly he couldn't discipline his sons properly as they grew up, as we shall see in the text? But leaving aside those questions for the moment, the fact is that David, back in his own palace, had a constant reminder of his own rebellion against God, that over in that wing were the 10 concubines. He is forgiven, he is restored, but he will not be able to forget his own history. Dale Ralph Davis again, on verse 3, these 10 concubines, who he provided for, had no relations with them. They were kept in confinement till the day of their death, living as widows. Dale Ralph Davis says there's something intensely, irretrievably sad about verse 3. These women are the victims of men's sin. They're like Tamar, if you remember, Absalom's sister, and the awful things that happened to her. Their lives sort of hit a permanent dead end. And it just, you know, isn't sin horrible? Doesn't it do dreadful things to us and to those around us? And don't we need to remember that every day? Because Satan is constantly trying to wrap sin up with cotton wool and sweets and sugar and make it seem attractive and to our advantage, and actually it's horrible. It's horrible. It's not just someone else's sin that's horrible. It's my sin that's horrible. You see, there's no point in reading all this stuff that happened long ago if we just think it has nothing to do with us. No, it's written down because it speaks to us. You see, and David is reminded of his own sin. And you know, Paul, he never forgot he'd been a savage persecutor. And many years later, in 1 Timothy 1, verse 15, he writes to Timothy, and he calls himself the worst of sinners twice over. The worst of sinners. The worst of sinners. Now, is that just a form of words? No, I think it's an expression of a humbled heart. And we need to be there with him. You see, it's so easy. Sin teaches us, Satan teaches us, it's all other people who are terrible sinners. Well, actually, when God's Spirit confronts us, when before the holiness of God, everything about us is exposed and known, it's we who are terrible sinners. And it's important for us, along with the joy of forgiveness, never to forget our unworthiness. It won't be 10 concubines in a corner of your palace, but it'll be other things that just remind you, you do well to keep a humble heart. John Newton, whose great hymn we sang this morning, One Time Slave Trader, wrote this: I am persuaded, a broken and contrite spirit, a conviction of our vileness and nothingness. Vile, it's not a word we would easily use of ourselves. That's the word he used. And nothingness. We want to be something. Our vileness and our nothingness, connected with a, it's lovely 18th century language, a cordial acceptance of Jesus as revealed in the gospel. So remembering I'm vile and nothing, but I wholly, lovingly accept Christ as revealed in the gospel. This is the highest attainment we can reach in this life. Depend upon it, says Newton. If you walk closely with God for 40 years, you will at the end of that time have a much lower opinion of yourself than you have now. Isn't that interesting? 40 years of being a Christian, and you'll be more humble than you are today. If you've walked closely with God, because as you get near to heaven, you will know you are the least worthy occupants of that glorious place. So, God's discipline, then God's restoration. You see, God was absolutely committed to restore his anointed king. Back in chapter 18, there was a refrain that Dom pointed out. Verse 19, the Lord has delivered the king from the hand of his enemies. Verse 28, the messenger says, praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my Lord the king. Verse 31, the Lord has delivered you today from all who rose up against you. And indeed, the Lord did. Despite Absalom's rebellion, David was still king. Despite Sheba's rebellion, God's purpose couldn't be thwarted. So Sheba goes out, and he goes out to kind of raise the northern kingdom against David. Look in verse 14 of chapter 20. He passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel Beth Maacah. Now Abel Beth Maacah, I think, is 30 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. It's right at the north of Israel. And through the entire region of the Bichrites, who gathered together and followed him. Now, he's the son of Bichri, so I should think these are his relatives. But the impression given in verse 14 is that though he's traveled all this area, actually he wasn't terribly successful in raising a big army. And it seems at the end that he's just not got a great number of followers up there. And God uses the men of Judah. There's that lovely phrase in chapter 20, verse 2. Where the men of Judah stayed by their king. The men of Israel deserted David. The men of Judah stayed by, literally clung to their king. So God used the men of Judah. And then he used Abishai and Joab, didn't he? Abishai, who began the pursuit, and Joab. And four times over in chapter 20, verse 6, verse 7, verse 10, and verse 13, it says they pursued, they pursued, they pursued, they pursued Sheba. And Sheba ends up trapped in this little town, Abel Beth Maacah, way up north. And enter, at this point, the wise woman. Her wisdom gets referred to in verse 60. I mean, she's introduced to us. We never do discover her name. The first thing and the main thing we know about her was that she was a wise woman. Verse 16, and it gets referred to at the end, verse 22, went to all the people with her wise advice. And she is the only person to mention the Lord in the entire story. So there's some wisdom, I think, real wisdom going on in this lady. And instead of stirring up trouble, she uses words to make peace. That's novel. Instead of using words to stir up trouble, she uses words to make peace. You see, words can be healing and restorative and lovely. Just try specializing in words that make for peace. Wouldn't that make for happier homes and happier marriages and happier churches and all the rest of it? To specialize in words that made for peace. So she appeals directly to Joab, and she talks about this city, Abel, that it was had a history of being faithful and peaceful, a place of wisdom. This saying, get your answer at Abel, that was the sort of place it was. You're trying to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. She lays it on, and she wins the day. And she saves the city and many lives. By persuading the men of the city to behead Sheba, when Joab says, well, it's actually only Sheba I'm after. But she said, fine, I'll get his head down to you as soon as possible. And off she goes, and her wisdom is, execute this man. And then the whole thing will be over. And that's what they do. And the whole thing is over. Now, to owe your death to a woman was regarded as a particular disgrace. Sheba met a disgraceful end. And the rebellion, which began with Sheba's trumpet blast in verse 1, ends with Joab's trumpet blast in verse 22 to say, it's all over, folks, let's go home. And then the conclusion is verse 23 to 26, which basically is a kind of summary statement. You've had exactly the same in chapter 8, 15 to 6. It's not exactly the same, it's very similar. And it's basically a statement saying, this is how it was. David ruled. And these were the key people in his government. This is the cabinet. And what it's saying is that in the face of all the rebellions, David was still king. And God reestablished the rule of his anointed king against the rebels. And that is the bottom line of the Bible story. What's the Bible but a story of rebellion? Genesis 3. It's a story of a rebellion we have been part of. But it's also the story of the restoration of the rule of God in our world through his anointed king. And, you know, despite every apparent setback and human rebellion and everything that goes wrong, we do not pray in vain when we pray as Jesus taught us, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Your kingdom come, your will be done. We need to be teaching our children to pray that. We need to be praying it ourselves. Your kingdom come, your will be done. Because it is coming. It is coming. And Jesus came to triumph over sin and over death itself. And he has undone and is undoing the very worst that Satan can do. And one day, every rebel will lay down his weapons at the feet of Jesus Christ. That's the truth. That's where it's heading. So, we're left with a warning and encouragement. The warning is don't just be associated with God's king, but share his spirit of grace and mercy. Be filled with his spirit in gracious self-giving rather than proud self-assertion, in kind and gentle words, not sharp and aggressive words, in speaking peace and forgiveness and self-sacrifice. And then, you know, we're going to be like Jesus. That'll make all the difference. Share his spirit. And also, live always in confident hope. Whatever the apparent setbacks and troubles, and there will be setbacks and troubles in our own lives, in our own families, in our churches, in our land, in our world. There are all sorts of frightening things. And then different generations. You know, we sometimes think it's getting worse and worse, but, you know, imagine, my father was brought up in the 30s. Okay, he was born in the generation where all the men went off to the First World War in the trenches, and so many of them never came back. And he was part of the second century, and all the men went off again, and so many of them didn't come back. And you had, you know, Nazi Germany, and you had fascist Italy, and you had militaristic Japan, and it was a pretty frightening world. Pretty frightening world. And, you know, you go back, and Napoleon was pretty terrifying in his time. We're no longer terrified. You know, mothers used to say to their children, you know, you go to sleep because Nappy will come and get you, meaning Napoleon. And that was actually a way they kept them quiet. You should try that. They won't know what you're talking about. But that was the level in our culture, in our nation, of the sense of the horror of this guy who was coming to invade. And he only narrowly failed. Just as Hitler narrowly failed. But you know, what I'm trying to say is that every generation will have its horrors and its stories. And sometimes we think, oh, it's so out of control. You know, North Korea, whatever President Trump is up to. And Putin, he's a pretty sinister character. And all the way around, you know, what is the EU, what's Brexit? You know, all this sort of stuff. And we can feel afraid. And Satan wants us to feel afraid. And the Bible's telling us, take heart, because every rebellion is going to fail. And there's one king who's going to triumph. And his name is Jesus. At the name of Jesus, every knee will bow. And every tongue confess that he is Jesus.